Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Sargon. Sara, how are you doing?
No, fine. Nice rain. Joburg is doing what Joburg should do.
Yes, ever since I've gotten to the Cape about 2 weeks ago, I've had nothing but wind, which I think is very on-brand, but it's kind of amusing how different it has been from Joburg. We've also got Maurice Ritt today. Maurice, how are you doing?
How's Nick? How's it, sir? Can't believe you tweeted and moved to the Cape, Nick.
I know, but you know, I saw the water crisis coming down the tracks, and I thought, you know, maybe I should actually take the things I say on the show seriously for once, and get out of the way of the water crisis shouting, which is
strange.
Well, yeah, no. Hopefully everyone had their buckets out to collect all the rain. So apologies again for the excessive echo on my side. Hopefully that should be sorted this week or in the next couple of days. It should be at least be reduced as I set more stuff up here. But let's get into our first news story of today. And this is what's going on with the South African Defence Force. So anyone who has followed at all any news about the Defence Force over, I would say, at least the last 10 years, knows that the South African Army and military in general is just not in a great shape. One of the very big problems is maintenance and logistics in general, with lots of problems with vehicles that are not being repaired or having parts replaced correctly. Despite the very expensive, very corrupt arms deal of the early 2000s, there's still quite a lot of South African gear, which is still dating back to the 70s. And after, you know, being driven around Namibia, Angola, and South Africa for many decades, you can imagine the state that equipment is in. But probably the parts of the Defence Force that are suffering the most are the Air Force and the Navy. Why? These are expensive, technically complicated areas of the service, and they require a lot of money to keep running. According to the Defence Force's latest annual report, the Air Force has been in decline basically for 12 years. It had set a target of giving its pilots 12,000 cumulative flying hours. It only managed 6,900 of the 26 Gripen fighter jets that South Africa bought very expensively from Sweden in the early 2000s. Only two are currently able to fly. When it comes to our ships, there was a target set of 8,000 hours that they should be at sea, patrolling the waters off the coast, intercepting smugglers and anyone else causing problems. And they only managed 2,641 sea hours, according to the defense report. A defense analyst, Helmand Heitman, says that this has been essentially an implosion of the defense force. He said drug smugglers and poachers are operating with impunity, and the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment just lacks the capacity to enforce the law. Crimes such as abalone poaching are costing South Africa something around 1 billion rand a year. A professor who has expertise on this said that yachts and other recreational vessels have almost free rein and are not inspected and are being used to smuggle drugs into the country. There are also sophisticated Chinese criminal groups which are using our essentially unpatrolled waters to conduct smuggling and other types of illegal operations off the coasts. There is an 8 billion rand backlog in maintenance. And recently, report by the Auditor General into which departments in national government have the most misspending flagged the Defence Force as being one of the prime culprits, or the Department of Defence more specifically. Because our pilots are not able to get the fuel or the time or the aircraft to fly, many of them are having to resort to being exclusively in simulators in order to train their skills, which obviously is suboptimal. It means also that even light aircraft are able to fly over the border and land on farms and things, smuggling in goods from across the borders of South Africa. Sara, this is, I think, one of the very big underlying problems that, you know, connects to so many of these other issues that we talk about daily. when we talk about a problem like porous borders, crime, illegal immigration, stuff like that, it's all very well and good having fiery speeches about, you know, we're going to drive the foreigners out, we're not going to let them take jobs here, and we're going to, you know, get all worked up about this or that. But if you can't actually enforce control of your borders, it's all sort of just hot air and nonsense signifying nothing. What do you make of this?
Look, it's all about enforcement in one way or the other. But if the Defence Force does nothing other than patrol sea lanes and sea borders and air to some extent well, if they do nothing else for South Africa and cut down the sophisticated criminal syndicates that are coming into and taking out of South Africa, they would be doing us a hell of a favor. Even if, you know, if they don't, there's no call for submarines, you know, go for the stuff that's not as expensive. But it's very much a hangover from that corruption, the arms deal of the late 1990s. And the fact that there's never really been held anyone to account. Shabir Sheikh is convicted, released for phony ill health. Zuma is still awaiting his day in court 20 years later. And the Defence Force has been, the Ministers of Defence have been the most, by and large, the most uninspiring people who know nothing. And I think, I suspect it really remained a source of corruption until the point where there's almost nothing left to do. It is symptomatic to me of part of the worst of the governance of the last 30 years. You know, our borders, our sea borders are wide, etc. I don't say it's easy, but everything about it is, I think, a source of unbelievable shame for this government. And you know, we don't need to be sending troops sitting marooned in hotspots in Africa. Our duty is to ourselves first, and then to take part in peacekeeping missions or whatever they might be. And one has some very serious doubts about whether those are being conducted on behalf of the country or on behalf of individuals within the country who have stakes in mineral resources in other parts of Africa. It's absolutely just shameful.
No, exactly. That's what, of course, makes us worse, is the fact that our military continues to be used as a sort of prestige tool. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, if I was, you know, the Lord Emperor of South Africa, God forbid, I would probably use our defense force in places around the continent, because Africa's instability, I think, definitely affects South Africa. But it's not equipped to do the jobs it's being asked to do. It's being asked to do these peacekeeping operations in DRC, which it is woefully inequipped to do. And the most recent round saw South Africans basically unable to get air support, trapped in their base, being mortared continuously by Rwandan-backed rebels, which, you know, is not at all fair to our soldiers whose lives are being put at risk without any proper support. We're also, of course, seeing South Africa not really seeming to have that much of an impact in northern Mozambique, where it was deployed to help fight the ISIS insurgency there alongside Rwandan and private contractors. Just kind of everywhere, the Defence Force is being used as like a prop, but it's increasingly hollow. Morris, what do you make of this story?
Yeah, I think we need to decide what we need a Defence Force for. I don't really know why we need to have, 30 Gripen fighters. We obviously don't face any convention. Yeah, we don't face any conventional threats from any of our neighbors, even that Islamic insurgency. It's, I think, 2,500 Ks away. So it's not like, you know, something we have to really worry about right now. But I think we should have re-looked at what the Defence Force was in 1994. And it would make sense, I think, to have a Coast Guard and a kind of a Border Guard. And maybe, you know, a small number of special forces guys that can be deployed when there is something that you need to sort out. But we don't need such a big defense force, actually. As I say, we don't face any real conventional threats. And I think Sarah makes a good point about the armies being deployed to places where they're protecting individuals' interests. I think it's pretty much well known now that the guys were sent to the Central African Republic were protecting commercial interests and nothing had nothing to do with South African interests or interests of the African Union, whatever the case is. And I mean, the Battle of Bangui, I think 13 South Africans died, which was the most lives lost in a single battle by South Africans since World War II, I think. In a single contact. So yeah, it's I think we need to relook at what the Defence Force is, and we probably need some kind of deterrent, but I definitely don't think it needs to be as big as it is. And we obviously, and unless we're going to fund the thing properly, then we need to forget about having one as big as it is, because part of the reason is simply the funding isn't there. I mean, I think the main reason these Gripens aren't flying is simply because there's no money to put jet fuel into the things.
No, exactly right. I mean, this question as to why we bought these Gripen fighters in the first place, you know, I think the only two other sort of major countries that fly them are Sweden, who built the things, and Brazil, who I think I would also be skeptical of why they chose to. You know, Brazil's not exactly a super corruption-free country. But exactly, you know, there's just a sort of aimless drifting where the Defense Force is kind of moved around like a puppet on a stage, but actually it's not clear what its purpose is. It's just used as a cash cow to drain resources of. And Sara, as you say, it's the sort of perfect example of misgovernance and the destruction of state institutions, particularly, I think, in the Zuma years, but beginning all the way back in the late 90s. Any final thoughts, Sara, before we move on?
I just want to remember from the report that Arms Corps and Danel have facilities in ports that are not functioning. I don't know what those facilities are. I don't know anything about them. But now that I know something about them, it's time to, train our eyes again on those two SOEs, what they're doing, why they're doing it, whether they should be got rid of or sold off. You know, it gets around to management of SOEs again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, South Africa has actually produced some pretty good military equipment over the decades. And our Defence Force still has some pockets of excellence in it, but you know, they're just swimming against such a strong tide of mismanagement here. It makes it difficult for anything to be done. Okay, moving on to the continued fractiousness, I guess, between the EFF and MK. Well, in this case, focusing more on MK. We talked last week about how MK's Secretary General, after being in the job and then out of the job and then in the job, has been kicked out of the job again to be deployed, it seems, to Lesufi's Gauteng government, even though he was kicked out of his roles there originally for corruption charges. But while Dr. Maseko from the MK party has gone off to be in the Gauteng provincial government, MK has decided to appoint a new secretary general, and it is Floyd Shivambu, who only recently joined the party, defecting from the EFF. This is quite a rapid promotion for Floyd Shivambu, who left the EFF to become the national organizer of MK and is now the Secretary General, which I guess is what the usually second in command or third in command of a political party. Zuma confirmed the appointment, saying that Commander Floyd Shivambu will assume all the functions and tasks of Secretary General as prescribed by the constitution of the MKP. The president and national officials will, in line with the constitution of the organization, announce the necessary changes pertaining to the vacant role of national organizer. So, Marius, let me start with you. Quite a rapid promotion, but I suppose that's what happens in the MK party when you don't have to hold any elections for any of these positions.
Yeah, I mean, also, if you just listen to these, it's quite similar to the EFF. With all these grandiose titles. I mean, I think Jacob Zuma calls himself the Commander General or something ridiculous. Like your cat there, Nick. So, but yeah, it's all, and you know, it's actually sad in a way, these guys with their camo uniforms and so on. I mean, who are they fighting? Like, Jacob Zuma was president of South Africa and he left and he was legally kicked out of office. There was nobody came at gunpoint and said, you got to leave. You know, and also we have free and fair elections. We are a democracy. I don't know why they got to call themselves commanders in this. You know, it's like really people just cosplaying at being soldiers. It's like these kind of toy soldiers. And it's actually, you know, it's quite sad and it's quite pathetic as well. But Yeah, LARPing. I see somebody puts it, that's the word I was looking for. Somebody in the comments said LARPing. I think that's exactly it. So, but it's probably a good move by Jacob Zuma. I think whatever you think of Floyd Chivambu, he's a pretty clever and capable guy, I think. So it's probably a good move. But, I mean, I'm sure Floyd Chivambu is going to come short against Jacob Zuma at some point. And we know that Jacob Zuma and Floyd Chivambu clashed in the past when Zuma was president and Chivambu was still in the EFF. So there probably isn't all that much love lost there. And also, I mean, this organization is obviously just Jacob Zuma's private vehicle. As soon as he passes away or gets gets a bit older and is a bit, can't really keep up the pace, I doubt MK is going to be where it is. But I think also something that's quite important to notice or to just think about, the two biggest parties in South Africa are the ANC and the DA. And they're obviously two of the only parties which have real proper internal democracy. If you look at most of the other parties, I think you could probably argue the IFP and the Freedom Front Plus are fairly democratic internally. But in parties like Action SA, they haven't had a leadership election. MK is obviously not democratic. I think EFF pretends to be, but nobody's challenged Julius Malema as leader of the party since he founded it. And I think pretty much Malema wants.
Yeah, Julius Malema threatened to destroy Floyd Chivambu if he ever challenged him for leadership. So.
Exactly. And there was a guy who was kicked out now for, I think, because he was opposed to Godrej Gadi, or he was supporting Godrej Gadi. I can't remember. Something to do with Godrej Gadi. And this guy was kicked out to the party for going against what Julius Malema wanted. So, yeah, I think that's just also something to think about, that the two parties with fairly robust internal democracy, the ANC and the DA, are our two biggest ones. We can also, I mean, they can ask questions about the ANC's internal democracy, because I think it's pretty obvious that votes get bought at various conferences, but that's a story for another day, I think.
Indeed. Apologies for my cat hogging the camera there for a little bit. I think she's feeling a bit bored. But so I think what's kind of interesting about MK's sort of posturing is that they almost seem to be claiming to fight a guerrilla war against the ANC. On their posters was the phrase Maibuye, which I can't remember exactly what it means, but it's something like let him come back or we are taking it back or something like
that. It means come back, yeah.
Come back, exactly. So it's like there's this sort of, they're almost kind of trying to position themselves as like a guerrilla army fighting against the new regime, which in this case is the corrupted ANC that we're going to liberate from itself, which is, you know, just kind of mad, particularly when it's a party that's just so transparently a vehicle for mischievousness of various types. Sarah, what do you make of this? I mean, I guess part of why they're maybe putting Floyd Chivambu in this position is not just because, you know, he's got some skills organizing and in politics, but also because I suspect MK probably wants to try and broaden their appeal beyond KZN, and putting someone who's not from KZN and who's not Zulu in a senior position like that maybe will kind of break up the perception of MK as like a Zulu thing.
They want to be seen as a sort of ethnic, non-ethnic party, you know. So in other words, not. And I think I agree with Marius about how pathetic it is that you have this pretending to be, you know, military. I mean, it was probably a Malema, but now it's sort of reaching ridiculous levels. But I live in hope that all their new acquisitions in the form of former public protector, money. Sorry, I forgot just something from Jimmy Manye, but his real name, Mzwaneli, Floyd. They are just, you know, the last people that any other party would want as members and as potential position holders. I mean, absolutely the worst. And once Zuma becomes increasingly the Joe Biden of South Africa, you can just imagine the fights, the leadership fights that are going to occur, not to mention his daughter, Dudizile, who managed to get representation on the Pan-Africanist Assembly by persuading the autocratic countries that surround us to vote for her when the EFF-ANC coalition had decided that they would support the ANC. I mean, it's the sort of stuff of which levels of embarrassment cannot begin to contain what MK and increasingly EFF could possibly mean for South Africa. They might be dangerous, but with any luck, they might mostly turn their revolutionary zeal on each other in the long run.
Yeah, I think I've said it before, but I think this is one of the big questions of South African politics going forward is, can MK stabilize into something that's more than just, you know, a hideout and a refuge for Zuma and his associates? Can it actually become the radical far left party that it pretends to be? Sort of what I think the EFF was more successful at doing in a lot of ways, but ultimately I think is failing because it was too focused simply on Mandela, who I quite frankly I do not believe is nearly as talented or as clever as Zuma, who I think is a truly underrated intellect in our politics. I wish he'd used his powers for good, but sadly we don't live in that world. Maurice, any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think we mustn't forget that Jacob Zuma is 82, and during the election campaign, there were stories of him not being able to attend rallies because he was wasn't that well. And even if he remains fairly healthy, I think just his levels of energy. I mean, once you get to your mid 80s or whatever, you know 5 o'clock, getting up at 5 o'clock and having 16-hour days, and you know all this palace intrigue, I think starts getting a bit tiring. And you think, I mean, you know, it doesn't. I mean, you by the time you're in your 80s, you think you over all this backstabbing and politics and whatever, you just want to sit on your porch and watch your grandchildren play. But obviously, Jake, you know, that's not what Jacob Zuma wants at the moment. He's got, I think also a lot of it is, I mean, I think he feels quite aggrieved. I think this is also a lot of, I mean, MK is just a revenge vehicle. I think he probably feels quite aggrieved of how he was kicked out of the ANC and, or kicked out of being president. So he's probably, yeah, I mean, he's this is, I think, just his revenge. But yeah, I mean, I think when something happens to Jacob Zuma, or if he's just too old to carry on, then that could be the end of the MK. So it's probably quite important for the party to try to build some structures.
Sorry, I just have to I suspect it's ahead, more difficult to keep up with the number of grandchildren he has than to run MK.
Yeah, he's got quite a few. Sorry, my cat is now sitting on my mouse.
As he should.
She's clearly a fan of MK. She doesn't like all this slander. So it's kind of interesting to me. I wonder how MK, when Zuma either steps down or passes away, what move he's going to, how they're actually going to select a new leader, because they don't have any elective processes in their party. Presumably it's just going to be like a big arena fight or some sort of, like, you know, there can only be one Highlander type deal. But
Maybe they'll get somebody like a soothsayer to look at the entrails of a duck or something.
Who knows? That guy, that party is completely opaque. Moving abroad to Ireland, actually, for a change. South Africa, you know, the world has had a huge number of elections now. The two biggest democracies in the world, India and the United States, have held elections. And it looks like Ireland is looking to get in on the big year of elections around the world, with the Irish Prime Minister calling a snap election to be held on the 29th of November. Maurice, can you tell us a little bit about this?
So it seems in Ireland they got a new Taoiseach, which is what they call their Prime Minister in April. A guy called Simon Harris, he replaced Leo Varadkar. And the two parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, I think that's what they're called, they're in coalition together at the moment, along with the Greens. And Sinn Féin, obviously the famous Irish Nationalist Party, which was the political wing of the IRA, did pretty well in those elections, in the last ones in 2020. And they seemed like to have quite a lot of momentum behind them. They also did pretty well in elections in Northern Ireland. They were in popular vote terms. They were the single biggest party in both Northern Ireland and Ireland. But recently, Sinn Féin did pretty badly in local government elections and in the elections for the EU Parliament. And they're doing pretty poorly on in opinion polls. So it seems that Simon Harris decided to kind of throw the dice here. And he thinks he'd have a between him and Fianna, between the two parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they probably think they're going to be able to get a majority. And from seems like Irish politics, it's I don't know if I want to call it opaque, but it seems that the two main parties are pretty much the same. They're both fairly centrist, you know, neither particularly right wing or particularly left wing. So yeah, I think they're probably going to be hoping that between the two of them they'll be able to get a majority. But I think Ireland's been facing a lot of the same problems that a lot of Europe has been. I think the two main issues that they'll be fighting the election on are going to be housing and immigration. Recently saw there was some riots in Ireland because people were upset about the high levels of migrants coming in. So yeah, I mean, I think they're facing a lot of the same problems that a lot of the rest of Europe is, and it remains to be seen if they're going to get this kind of anti-incumbency vote against them. I mean, in most of nearly every single election that's been held in 2024, the incumbents have done poorly. From, as you mentioned, India, the BJP lost the majority there. Obviously, yeah, in South Africa, the ANC lost the majority. In Botswana, the governing party just got voted out. In Japan, governing party there lost his majority. Emmanuel Macron's party did pretty poorly in the elections in France. In the UK, the Tories got voted out. So in almost every single democracy where there's been, in every single democracy where there's been an election this year, the incumbents have either been voted out or they've lost vote share. So it's quite something. And yeah, and we also have an election in Namibia at the end of the month, which could also see SWAPO do pretty badly. So yeah, I mean, maybe the Irish could kind of buck the trend here. And just looking at the opinion polls and so on, it looks like they could do that. I mean, the main rival to the big parties in Sinn Féin, and they don't do pretty poorly. So yeah, I think this is something to keep an eye out on, or an eye out for. And yeah, we'll see if the Irish decide to actually reward the parties in power.
That would be interesting. Although Ireland does have a habit of sort of zigging when everyone else is zagging, so I wouldn't be surprised if that is the case. I'm, you know, my Irish history is not very good, but I'm pretty sure that those two parties you mentioned, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, date back to disputes over a particular treaty signed with the British at the beginning of Irish independence in the early 20th century. So it's it's one of those like long ancestral splits that's divided Irish politics. And of course, the Sinn Féin being the far more radical left party, who have had their, I think this was their best ever election, the most recent one. So that may prove to be very short lived. Sarah, any thoughts on this one before we close up for today?
Yeah, I think it's very much the trend. And it's a case of Sinn Féin being reflecting the sort of elites and a left view and a very woke view. And like many others in Europe and even America, they didn't read the zeitgeist. And that is citizens feeling like, illegal immigrants are coming in and just sort of being dumped in, you know, rural parts of Ireland. It's affecting the housing crisis. And right now, pretty much everything that's Great Britain, Ireland, etc., has a housing crisis. So all of those real world basic issues have not been well read by parties like Sinn Féin. And I think Harris is taking a gap based on what's happening elsewhere. And I imagine Trump's success in America was probably the final determinant for him, and exactly the same sort of set of circumstances, a sort of woke American Democratic Party losing out to a much more canny zeitgeist reader like Donald Trump, irrespective of, you know, how anyone may feel about him as a personality.
Yeah, it's I would, you know, not to go on too much of a tangent, but I would highly recommend that many of these sort of center-left municipalities and countries just allow people to build some freaking houses. They won't have such housing crises. There's a very big problem all over, particularly the Western world, although, you know, it's not just confined to the Western world, of it being basically impossible to do new housing developments all over the place. And it's causing a big crisis all over the wealthy countries because people just can't afford housing or have to pay ridiculous amounts for rent, which is an entirely self-inflicted crisis as far as I'm concerned, for the most part. But anyway, okay, that's all the time we have for today. We hope that you found the show interesting. We will be back, of course, tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. If I can manage to push the end stream button with the cat harassing me, I will do so. But thank you very much, everyone, and have a wonderful afternoon. Cheers.